time, I'd like to introduce our wonderful speaker from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is Bobby C. Thank you.
My name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to participate. It's always an honor to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got sober young. I did a lot of young people's conferences, but I leaned over and I said, they have to be the hottest host committee I've ever seen. Now, I don't know about the dudes behind me, but George said they were looking good. So if George said so, it must be okay. I'd like to thank you. You know what? I tell you, I had a great time. For me, I'm a mummer, and today in Philadelphia is the Mummer's Parade, and with the exception of right after I got sober, I didn't participate, and in the late 70s, I was in over in the Middle East in the military, and I didn't get to any of the parades, but it's like the first parade, those three parades, I haven't missed a parade since sometime in the 60s, so when I found out that the Flyers were playing in the Winter Classic with the Bruins, I thought about it, but I said, not really. It's not worth giving the parade up just for a hockey game. But then I found out that Necky Pond was going on, and I got invited to speak. And I need to tell you, that was the deciding factor. That's why I gave up the parade to come up to Necky Pond this weekend. And you know what? I have a lot of friends here, just not from Philadelphia. I got some friends here from Jersey, and I can't mention anybody by name because I know I'm going to forget somebody and they'll get offended. But I have friends from many cities here, and that's a privilege that from working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had no friends at all. But I need to tell you about the Boston people. You know what? I love the Boston people. The Boston people, I tell you, I live in South Philadelphia, and it's just like it's like the guys in Southie, you know, before the yuppies came in and messed everything up. But it's the same type of neighborhood, and I love you guys, and you guys, you know, we had some good nature banter back and forth at the game today, but the one thing we did, there was common agreement, the Yankees do suck. Now I got to make amends to the people here from Icky Pa. So I'll make amends by giving them a plug. If you want to go to Icky Pa, the guys here from New York, they're registering people afterwards, sign up afterwards. All right. I got 8:25, so for your clock watchers. My directions are real clear. In Chapter 5, it's laid out. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what my life is like, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. It's June 2nd, 1988. I actually don't know if that was a date. I just made it up. And Memorial Day was late that year, and I came to a few days later, and I just picked that date. So it works. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar neighborhood, ethnic neighborhood in Philadelphia. I got seven brothers and sisters. We had no booze at all in the house. My father did not drink, and my mother could not drink. My mother was pregnant for 10 and a half years. She was. There's eight. I am 11 months older than my sister. I have a sister who's 11 months younger than I am. There's eight of us in a 10 and a half year span. Irish octuplets. You know. So besides being pregnant all those years, my mother also abused prescription medication. She had other mental illnesses, and because my father did not drink, he was smart enough not to have any booze in the house. My grandparents lived around the corner from us, my dad's parents, and my grandparents were immigrants, and the kids from the neighborhood used to make fun of them the way they spoke, but you know what? I loved my grandparents, and that's where all the parties were, the graduations, the christenings, you know. My father's one of 12. My mother from a much smaller family. She's one of 11. And so there was always a christening. There was always a party going on. And I couldn't wait till I always had to sit at the card table, but I couldn't wait till I get older so I could sit at the big table. But you know what? That's where the parties were, and I couldn't wait to get old enough to take part in that. That's where I had my first drink. I had it in my grandparents' basement, which was finished as a bar. I did not get drunk the first time I drank. I was just a kid the first time I drank, but I'll tell you what happened. I remember it like yesterday. It was Ballantine beer. And I remember that because Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father and that old scoreboard in right center field with the three rings. And I was running around the basement bar polishing off the half empties or the half fulls. It depends on your perception. And it was my uncles were pointing at me, said, look at him, look at Bobby. And that's what I always craved, the attention. I never felt a part of. And that would be true into early recovery. And that's pretty tough to do when you have 10 people living in a small 3-bedroom row home, but I never felt a part of. My drinking, though, really took off in high school. Now, I don't want to give you the impression I drank every day in high school. I didn't. I drank on the weekends, but the deal in high school, I felt kind of different. Most of the kids in my neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school. But since my parents, both their parents, both on my mom and dad's side, they were both immigrants, they knew the only way to make it in this country was by education. So they made a great deal of sacrifice to send me to a private school, and I went to a private Jesuit high school. And right away I felt kind of different because most of the kids who went to this school were from affluent families from the suburbs. It was just me and a couple of other dirtballs in the neighborhood who went to this school. And right away we had a reputation. You know, these kids, they were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, and me and the guys in the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. Now, I knew that was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me by my parents as a kid, by the nuns as a kid, but the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. And I'm compromising principles from a first start. You know, and I had a lot of nicknames, and one of those nicknames was Crazy Coil. And I would do things in my gut I knew was wrong, but you came to expect it. I was your entertainment committee. And that's what I did, you know. And we did things like we sold football pools, and if you hit, we didn't pay off. And you know what? And they kept coming back. You want to buy a particular substance? Well, we sold you a substitute substance, you know. We went through more oregano than a pizzeria. And they kept coming back. You know, we thought we were gangsters. We were idiots. That's what we were. But, you know, we thought we were something, you know. But I remember my freshman year at the prep, there was a football game, there was an away game, we rented a bus, there was drinking, there was fighting, there was police activity. It was really a lot of fun. And I remember my first day back to school, we all had to go see the disciplinarian. And he had us lined up outside his office. There was about 10 of us. And me and another kid from the neighborhood, we're the only two freshmen. And the priest came right up to us. He says, what's with you guys? You guys here like 2 weeks, you're already getting this jackpot? And I shrugged my shoulders. I said, you know, Father, it was just one of those things. See, you know, I didn't play football, so I didn't hang out with those kids. And even though I did well academically, I didn't hang out with the AP kids. They were a bit weird. I was there about a week, and I found out who the knuckleheads were, and that's who I hung out with. And that would be the story of my life. Every time put in a new situation, let me find out who the nitwits were, and I'm right in there with you, you know? Now, this school sits in the corner of 17th and Girard in North Philadelphia, a pretty rough neighborhood. 3 blocks away is the subway. Now, at the end of the day, these kids from the suburbs would have to take public transportation to go home. So they used to wait on 17th Street for the trolley to come pick them up to the subway. It's only a 3-block walk. You could walk them back and forth 10 times before that trolley would ever get there. Well, on the corner of 15th and Girard sat a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And when I was a junior, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple different reasons. You know, they had cold beer, they had dancers. But the real reason I went there was to show these kids from the suburbs how tough we were. And I'm not a tough guy, I never was. And every time I strolled out that street and I went in that bar, I was terrified. But I couldn't let anybody else know, like I was a legend in my own mind, Crazy Coil. Now, as you can tell by the name of the establishment, I'm not from the neighborhood. And you know, I'm what? I'm 17, I got a blazer. I mean, I look like I'm 12. They know that we go to school right down the street, but they figured if we're crazy enough to come in and ask for a drink, they were crazy enough to serve us. It was just nuts. You know, when it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education, and I knew I couldn't stay home because there'd be hell to catch. Because my parents made a great deal of sacrifices, and I don't like to catch hell. I love to create it, I don't like to catch it. So my options are limited. So what am I going to do here? I got no money, I have no skills, so I'm going to enlist. I enlist in the military. That really wasn't a bright move. There were people still living in Canada, so the military wasn't popular at that time. But I had enlisted, and after my training, I got sent overseas for 13 months. And that's where my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances. I never even smoked a joint. And I'm overseas, and several good friends of mine got killed, and I don't know how to handle that. Because in my family, we don't talk about nothing. It was all surface stuff, you know. And once you moved away, you went to get married or you went to school, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. Everything stayed inside you and everything stayed within the walls of the house. And that's not a shot at my folks. That's just the way it was. It was all surface stuff. We didn't talk about nothing. But booze numbed the pain, and that's what I did. I drank to numb the pain. I didn't distinguish myself in the service, but I didn't do badly either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. I just wanted to do my job, and I hope nobody noticed me, you know. And I was off to the races. When my tour was up, I came home. I enrolled in school. I went to St. Joe's. And, you know, back then it was a small school. I don't think we had more than 3,000 kids. We got about 15, 20 kids in the class. And I wound up taking a couple civil service exams. And I remember the end of the spring semester. The Phillies had since moved. They're now playing in the Vet Stadium down in South Philadelphia. And a kid from the neighborhood called me up. He said, "Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. One of those businessman specials, you know, like one of those weekday afternoon games." He said, "You want to go?" I said, "Sure." I'm not setting the classroom on fire. I'm not even an active participant. Not making the dean's list, but I'm not failing out either. Just doing barely enough to tread water where I don't get any heat. So I cut class, I go to the game, and it was an unusually warm day in May. And there's seven of us up at that top of the 700 level drinking that cheap watered-down beer. And the sun's beating down on us, and I'm getting kind of trashed. And I told the guys I was with, I said, "You know what?" I said, "I'm going to run down in the field and meet one of the players." And they kind of shrugged me off because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I used to tell people, "I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I did that." I didn't do nothing. I made stories up. I talked to you, I should have started off once upon a time. That's what I did. I never got off the stool, you know. So I had worked my way down. They used to have these picnic areas in the left field and the right field corners. And I had jumped over the fence. I ran out in the field. And the San Diego Padres were in town. And Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. And I went out and I shook his hand. I said, "Hey, Dave, how you doing?" And he looked at me. He said, "Brother, what are you doing out here?" And he's a pretty big dude, so from behind him, I saw the guards come, and I said, "Dave, I got to go now." So I start running towards the infield. I want to slide into second base. I don't know why. I just thought that'd be a pretty cool thing to do, right? Well, I'm booking. I'm running towards the infield, and there was more guards coming from the third base side, and I knew I couldn't do that. If I slid into second, I'd get caught. So I start walking towards first base. And I'm, I don't know, I'm close. I'm about 10 feet away from the guard, right? And I'm walking to give myself up. At the late second, I deked the guy, and I ran out in the outfield. Now, I'm running around like a screwball. It seems like 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to 2 or 3, right? But you know what? The place is going nuts. I mean, I'm in pretty good shape. I just got out of service. I'm juking and jiving. You got these guards, these young, short, fat guys in South Philly. They're tripping over each other. It looks like Keystone Cops. You know, they're. But you know what? I got nowhere to go. The fence is 10 feet high, you know. I'm drunk. I'm out of breath. I'm about to get sick. I finally stop running. I'm in center field. I stop running. They come up and they grab me and they take me off the field. I got a standing ovation from 37,000 people. Unbelievable. They take me up to the right field bullpen and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies and the Tugger gave me the thumbs up. You know. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from these guards because I made them look so stupid. You know what? They could have beat on me all day long because the way I pictured it, I said, "You know what, by the time I get out of jail, I'd be back in the neighborhood. I could drink for free off this story for at least a week." Now, this would be the type of story I'd make up, Bullshit Bob, right? But I got those four guys from the neighborhood. I actually pictured this. I was going to get beaten. I was going to get locked up, and I was going to go to the bar, and there would be, like, shot glasses set up. And just then, a Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Are you drunk? Are you high?" I said, "No, I'm just happy. I'm just happy to be here." He said, "Well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium." So he saved me from getting a beating, which I appreciated. But more importantly, he saved me from getting arrested. And that was important also. Because about 6 weeks later, one of them civil service exams kind of panned out. And I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They were hiring anybody back then. And I need to tell you, the drinking age in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has always been 21. The drinking age in Jersey at that time was 18. And where I lived in Philly, I could be across the bridge in Jersey quicker than other parts of Philadelphia. But once I got on the job, I no longer needed to do that. We had a guy, our mayor at the time was a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. And Frank was a former cop and police commissioner. He loved us. And we were nothing but a gang with badges. We were 8,300 strong. And we did whatever the hell we wanted to do. And I need to back up for a moment. I tell that story of running on the field for a couple of different reasons. One, it's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't a lover. I wasn't an athlete. I was none of that stuff. I was a lying thief and stinking, falling down, violent, drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody came in contact with. I was a creep. Secondly, it's a true story. I got those four guys in the neighborhood. They're still alive. They could back me up. But thirdly, and more importantly, I was a blackout drinker. I remember when I eventually got sober, I was at the VA hospital. A doctor came up to me. He said, listen, do you ever have any blackouts? I said, nope. He said, I must answer too quickly for him. He said, do you know what they are? I said, nope. Once he described them, I said, all the time. That's how I thought you had a good load. Like if you came to the next day, I thought everyone did that. You got loaded and you didn't remember. I would come up in the corner and the guys would be telling me the stunts I pulled the night before, and a few hours later I'd be retelling those stories like I had a memory of myself. I was a blackout drinker from the very first start, you know. So I get assigned to work North Philadelphia, and that's where I spent the first part of my career. And I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the tour, I would wail guys of the squad and drink because I saw things on the job that bothered me, but I couldn't tell my coworkers that because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys, to the point where I engaged in behaviors I knew was wrong, the way I treated people, spoke to people, and all that other nonsense, because I wanted to be accepted by these guys. I'm compromising principles and values from the very first start, and I had good teachers. I had the nuns, I had the Jesuits, I had the officers in the Air Force, I had my parents, I had good teachers, but I'm compromising principles from the very first start. And it was ugly, you know, and the handwriting was on the wall quickly for me. I was at work one day, and my immediate supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, you know what, kid? He said, you're smart, and you're going to go places, but that booze is going to mess you up, in one ear and out the other. I had my uncle. My uncle was a boss on the job, and we were at a family function one night. My uncle pulled me off to the side. He said, Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You better take it easy, or you're going to get yourself in a jackpot, in one ear and out the other. Several years later, when I got sober, on two separate occasions, I ran into that supervisor and my uncle in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized that at that point that my uncle was trying to 12-step me. And I remember going up to him. I said, Jimmy, I said, how come you didn't tell me? And you know, he gave me one of them old-timer smiles. He said, Bobby, you just weren't ready yet. Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I mean, I was the last guy to figure it out. I was 24 years old, and I was involved in an incident in which a 15-year-old kid lost his life. It was a terrible situation that could not be avoided. You know, the mental health professionals now have a phrase, suicide by police, but 20-some years ago, that wasn't around. And I used it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for my next 3 years. Drinking took me to a lot of my nevers. One of those nevers was drinking on the job. See, I wound up getting promoted or moved, and I can justify, like, the type of work I was doing. I wasn't hanging in churches, you know, so I justified what I was doing. I had a drink to, you know, just justify things. And unfortunately, one night, I was under the influence. I was drinking, and I was put in a position where I thought that I needed to do other substances, and I got involved in other substances, one of my biggest nevers. My use of other substances is very short. It lasted about 17 months. It caused me and a lot of other people a lot of problems, and out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's why I need to talk about that stuff. Please feel free to use your imagination. And looking at this crowd, you could do a good job. I have faith in you. You know? But it's just nuts. My life was just a mess. I remember one day I was sitting home from work. I'm reading the Daily News, and there's an article. At the end of the article, there's a series of questions. It said alcohol problems, drug problems, marital problems, depression, thoughts of suicide. I was 4 out of 5. Because I was single. But I'm sure if I was married... I've been batting 1,000. But you know, they talk about the moment of clarity. As soon as it came, it quickly left. But something made me cut that ad out. I stuck it in my wallet and I continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. Me and the guys I'm working with, we're in some trouble. We go to a bar to get our stories together. One thing led to another, just turned out to be another drunk fest. One of the guys I was with decided that he needed to go home, God forbid, like take care of some sort of family obligation. I decided I would give him a ride home. I did not think that I was drunk as he was, and he thought that was a good idea. I would see things in the movies or television, like with these cars, and I said, I could do that stuff, you know, especially since I'm not driving my car. So, and I now know things are pre-designed, stunt people know things are set up, but I'm in this car, I'm driving up this narrow one-way street, and there's a big wall on my left-hand side, a stone wall about 10 feet high, and there was a kid riding towards me on a bicycle, and I decided I was going to play chicken with this kid. For some reason, I thought it'd be funny to see this kid jump the curb and grab the wall. I don't know why I thought that'd be funny, but I thought it would be. And unfortunately, at the last second, we turned in the same direction. I ran that kid over. As he lay bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car with my nightstick and I was going to beat this kid because I thought he was milking me or the city for an insurance claim. The guy I was with prevented me from doing that. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw that off to the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, made some sort of smart aleck remark, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I knew I was in serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody helped me because I was such a creep. And believe me, I was a creep, you know, and I didn't know what to do. So what I did do, I got a case of beer, a bottle of liquor, and some other substances, and I checked into a hotel with the intention to consume all this stuff to build up the courage and my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the hotel door to kick me out. And all the booze is gone, the other stuff is gone. At this point, I'm suspended from my job. I no longer have access to my weapon, so I couldn't shoot myself. And I was out of options. I didn't know what to do. So what I did do, I go over the window. I opened up the window when I was going to jump out the window to end my life. And when I opened up the window, I was on the fifth floor. I remembered I was scared of heights. I made 23 jumps in the service. I never overcame my fear of heights. So I go in the bathroom and I fill the bathtub with water and had a blow dryer. I was going to pull the blow dryer into the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I pull the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I'm like short on cord. I'm about a foot and a half short on cord. And I got one foot in the tub leaning, trying to plug in it, you know. And it's like that scene out of Woody Allen movie where he tried to kill himself. I couldn't even do that. And it's okay to laugh, but I was in a mess. And I didn't know what to do. So the only other tool that I had left was my car. So I took one night spin to the neighborhood. I went to see my school, and I don't know why, the corner I hung on. And I start up the Falls Bridge, and I come down the East River Drive, which is a very winding road along the Schuylkill River. And this was a midday, also mid-morning, it was like 11 o'clock on a Wednesday or Thursday. And my intent was going to oncoming traffic, and it was important it was this time of day, because if it was any other time of day, I probably would have succeeded what I set out to do. And the speed limit on the drive back then, I know we reduced it recently, but back then I think it was about 25. And I'm doing about 50, and I'm cooked, and I'm whacked out of my mind, I'm just nuts. And I'm coming down the drive, and my first thought was going to oncoming traffic. Because I handle jobs like this, certain, you know, head-on collisions at a certain rate of speed certainly does the trick. And then I had flashed back on something that happened when I was a young guy in a job. I was about 22, 23. And I remember I had to do a notification. I don't know why this bothered me, because it's really not even on my top 20, 30 things that ever bothered me, but I guess it was, because I was always haunted by it. I had to knock on this guy's door, and he was an older guy to me, and everything's relative. He was probably in his late 30s, early 40s at that time. And I had to tell him that his son was killed in an automobile accident. And I can picture this like yesterday, that the guy just slumped against the door of his house. And the only way I can describe it, I actually saw the light leave this guy's eyes. You know, I was in court a few weeks later, and I'm walking down the hallway, and this guy stopped me. I didn't even recognize him. He must have aged 20 years. As much pain that I was in that day, and I knew I needed to end my life, there was no way that I can inflict this damage on an innocent family. But it wasn't me. It was God. I didn't realize that then. But I needed to end my pain, so I decided to wrap myself around one of these trees. And I handle jobs like this. You hit these trees at a certain rate of speed. That does the trick. Actually, if you just hit it right, they actually split the vehicle in half. Or if you're not belted in, you get ejected from the vehicle and struck by another vehicle. That does the trick, too. And by then, I just lost it. I'm just crying. And I'm flying. I'm coming down the drive. And I finally pull over. It's a boathouse row. And I finally pull over, and I just cry like a baby for about 5-10 minutes. Just heavy sobs. And I reached into my glove box where I always had the extra gun. And I reached in the glove box and the gun wasn't there. But inside the glove box was my wallet. And inside that wallet was that article that I clipped out of Daily News about 6 weeks before. And this is no longer there, but it's outside the last boathouse. They used to have one of these old glass enclosed phone booths. And I dialed the phone number up on the piece of paper. And the lady who answered the phone, I spoke to this lady like I never spoke to one in my life before. I told her the truth. I told her everything that was going on in my sad, miserable life, and God bless her, she listened patiently. And when I got done, she said, listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital? Somebody will be waiting to talk to you. And I said, okay. And it was about a 5-minute drive. I drove over. They were waiting for me, and they admitted me to their 10th floor psychiatric unit. And they kept me there for about 2 or 3 days, got me kind of stabilized. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to another VA hospital out in Coatesville. And I would spend another 6-8 weeks in their flight deck before I got put into an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I wasn't an alcoholic. Alcoholics were these poor people I was dealing with in North Philly on a daily basis. They were alcoholic. I thought my problem was other substances. If I left that crap alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I got this mental illness and heard this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress stuff they're now talking about. I got this from the job. I got this from my experience in the service. Maybe it's the neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mummer. But it can't be alcohol because I'm a beer drinker, and there's no way that you could be an alcoholic drinking beer. I mean, the only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Patty's Day or New Year's Day or like payday, but I was a beer drinker. You know, and it's just nuts, you know. So when I finally got put into the alcohol and drug ward, at this point I probably got about a good 10 weeks behind me in various nut woods. So it's finally nice to have been in a place where there's handles on both sides of the door. And it's amazing how quickly the arrogance comes back. So I start wandering through, getting the lay of the land. And I wander into the day room. And into the day room, I found they had the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I zipped through the steps. I had about 6 of them done, you know. The amends, they're out. You don't do it. Not my neighbor. No amends. No, you can't do that. That's weakness. No amends, you know. But what I, and that shows you how clueless I was. But what happened later that night, 2 men came up and they were part of the treatment facility committee. Did not know that then. Would find out later. They came up to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't relate to, didn't identify with, or didn't like, I'd immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. But what I realized at that point, that my decision to do something about my drinking was definitely premature. Because I was looking around my peers in group, and they were whacked. You know, these guys had wives who hated them, stay away orders, you know, custody issues, you know, support issues. I didn't have any of that. Probably due to the fact that I'd never been married, I didn't have any children. May had something to do with that. A lot of these guys had legal problems. I didn't have any legal problems, probably due to the fact because I had a gold shield in my back pocket. A lot of these guys had employment problems. I didn't have any. I only had 2 jobs. I went from high school to the service to the city. I still work for the city, you know. I was looking for the differences and not the similarities. But what bothered me the most, without any question, was at the end of the meeting when everyone got in a circle and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people are about, I definitely don't want nothing to do with you, because I hated God. And I hated God for a lot of different reasons. And I know they're strong words, and I'm telling you, it doesn't even begin to sum up the feeling of hate that I have towards God. And believe me, they were all legitimate. And one of the reasons I hated God the most, I talk about my mom's mental illness. My mom was like a fundamentalist in the church movement. She was in charismatic meetings she would go to. She thought she could speak in tongues and things like that. And I came home from school one day. I was 15 years old. I'm in the house about 10 minutes, and I come across my mother. My mother had slit her wrist. And I remember she looked up at me. She said, Bobby, help me. And I looked down at her and said, good for you. And I walked out of the house. And I got the older guys on the corner to go to the state store to get a bottle of wine, and I drank the wine. I came home later that night. My father told me what happened. I acted surprised. I said, oh, yeah, how about that? That happened when I was 15. I got sober when I was 27. That's 12 years of hating God, and that's a real good hate. And it would be a few more years before I would even address this issue. So I'm not holding any hands, and I'm not saying any prayers. When it was time to get out of the VA hospital, a nurse came up to me, and I'm saying this not to get a laugh. She had to be a member of Al-Anon. She just saw all through my BS. And that's all it was. It was just a facade to keep people at bay. And she came up to me and she said, the only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you, that's the best piece of advice I got. And that's where I would get my recovery. I got it in AA. I didn't get it at the VA hospital. They do tremendous work, though. They drain the oil. They tighten the bolts. I mean, they did some good work. But I would get my recovery in AA. And I go to AA every single day, 2-3 times a day. I don't drink coffee. I've never had in my life. To this day, I've never had a cup of coffee. I don't make it. I don't smoke cigarettes. To this day, I've never smoked cigarettes. I don't empty any ashtrays. I know that's not an issue now, but back then it was an issue. I'm not emptying any ashtrays. Big book meetings or step meetings, definitely not. I would leave it to break. I had something more important to do. Tradition meetings, rules, absolutely not. Rules are for other people. I'm here to enforce them. I don't like to follow them. They're for other people. I'm interested in war stories. And the moment that the speaker said something about his background that I caught late, didn't relate to, didn't like, or just, you know, I would immediately tune him out. Too busy to listen to the messenger, not the message. But I made meetings. I was a meeting maker. And I was an idiot. I was sitting in this bar. I was sober, I don't know, about 10, 11 months. And that because he sold real good roast beef. That was my excuse. It was a lie, but that was my excuse back then. And so a couple guys from that neighborhood, I'm drinking seltzer, that was okay. Drinking seltzer out of rock glass. A couple guys from the neighborhood come in, they just start busting. They were busting my shoes, giving me a hard way to go. And this one kid just stood a little too close to me, and I stood up and I punched him in the face with the rock glass in which I was drinking out of. He dropped, he opened up, he bled like a pig. I remember the guys, the wagon crew, handled the job. I knew one of the guys. He had pulled me off to the side. He went to hear my version of the story, and I had told him. I can still see the look of disgust in his eyes when he told me. He said, "You better get the hell out of here." He said, "You're nuts." I mean, that's the type of stuff I was doing, you know. I was sober 1 year, and my group at that time, you would tell your story. And I told my story 1 year anniversary, and it was amazing. It was thunderous applause. The blind could see, the lame walked. It was really, truly miraculous. And people came up, and they patted me in the back and said, "Bobby, you're doing so good." And I was dying inside. I lied during my entire story. I identified myself as an alcoholic because in my group at that time, you couldn't talk about anything else. So that's how I identify myself as such. In fact, when I told my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys don't want to hear that. You want to hear all the quotes, and I was a pretty sharp guy. I knew how to hold on to information and give it back to you. And you came up and you patted me in the back and you told me how well I was doing, and I was dying inside. I was sober 23 months and beat another man with a baseball bat. Forget what step I was working that day. I did everything wrong you could do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only thing I didn't do, I just didn't drink. And I thought that was the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I celebrated my second anniversary. Actually, I didn't celebrate it. It arrived, and I didn't celebrate it. A month after my second anniversary, 25 months sober, making the regular attendance in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, but 25 months before, I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober, I want to eat my gun. Safe to assume my life was unmanageable. I was a liar, thief, and a cheat. I was a creep with the new women. I did everything wrong. I used to go, in my early recovery, first couple years, I used to go to a lot of gentlemen's clubs, right? But I drank soda, it was all right. And I would get my picture taken, like with the entertainer, right? And I would come to the meetings and pass the picture to the old-timers because I knew they would like that. I can still picture them. They were looking at the picture, and they would look at me, and they would just shake their head and close their eyes and said, "Kid, please keep coming back." And I thought they were being facetious. I said, "All right, I'll keep coming back." I was just nuts. I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering, why is everybody blowing this guy's anonymity? I said, he must be a really tough SOB. I don't want to tangle with him. Here I was. I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. We had a cork board, first name, last initial, date of month, how many years you're celebrating, an anniversary board. If Joey A. had 3 years and Bobby C. had two and Joey A. went out, I said, "Good, he's out, I'm in." Seniority, everyone's talking about their time. I didn't care. No one asked me to be their sponsor. No one wanted what the hell I had. I didn't carry the message. I carried the disease. And the only time I got my hand up to share was serene people scared the hell out of me. If I was at a meeting and things were real cool, and I was very uncomfortable. So that's the only time I got my hand. I would get my hand up and share some insanity and set the room off, and I felt back. I got comfortable. I was nuts. So a month after my second, and I need to back up for a little bit. You know, these guys, we got a in Philly, there's like a diner like on every other corner, and just like there's a tap room, sometimes too, it's right on the corner. At the end of the meeting, we go to the diner. It's a big hangout, right? And guys would come up to me afterwards and said, Bobby, I mean, you had to run over me to get out the meeting, right? There was no way you missed me. And they said, Bobby, we're going to diner. You want to go? I said, nope. God forbid I never get invited, though. But I never went. I mean, these guys, they were nuts. But they weren't nuts. I was nuts. They tried. Time after time after time, they were kind to me, and I was just an idiot. And the harder I tried to keep them away, it just worked in reverse the more they tried, you know. They came up to me one night after a meeting and said, Bobby, you working this weekend? And I said, no. And I knew by then it was the wrong answer. Because they said, good, because we're going on a retreat with this weekend and we're going to take you with us. Now, I need to tell you, I make fun of these guys, but the truth is they were really decent men. But there was no way that I can go on a retreat with these guys. See, they knew, because in most meetings in the city, depends where you live in the city, you hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer. I'm not holding hands and I'm not saying the prayer. In fact, I'm not even respecting your right to pray, because I cause a scene. I kick the chair, the body language, and all the heavy sighs. So I'm a real complete idiot. So they know that I got a problem with God. And they say, Bobby, we're going to take you on a retreat this weekend. Now, I need to tell you, the worst meeting to go to is Sunday night after retreat. Like, I'd be at the meeting on Friday, so where the hell's everybody at? Like, half the attendance is whacked, you know? And then Saturday, I said, man, where's everybody at? Sunday night, here they come. I said, oh, Christ, they were all away for the weekend. They all come floating in, and, you know, and they sprouting wings and halos. But you know what? The only thing I did right, and I never did nothing right in my first couple years, I never left the meeting. That's the only thing I did do right, and I would stay there, you know? So they take me up to this retreat. It was a Friday afternoon. I'm in the back of the car, big guy on each side of me. It's like role reversal. At work I drive, you're in the back. So they take me to this retreat house, and the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. Because, you know what? I'm sober long enough in AA at this point, knowing that you couldn't get kicked out. But I'm also sober enough in AA long enough, my experience, that to know that not everyone is always greeted as warmly as the next person for any number of reasons. There is no way that I can tell these guys about my mom, because what would they really think of me then? So, but the need for me to be accepted by these guys are there, and the truth is, there was something, I felt safe with these men. I had watched these guys long enough, I knew they were walking the walk and they were good men. I was just, because I never dealt with anything, that's why I was so uncomfortable. So the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot gets in my stomach. And we get there, it's like Friday afternoon, 4:30, 5 o'clock. They say, Bobby, we want to introduce you to the retreat master. I said, all right, come on, let's get this over with. So they take me down this long carpeted hallway. They knock on the door. The guy says, come in. I come in. He sticks his arms out. He wants to hug me. He's my disciplinarian from high school. Not only that, but he's a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he starts talking to me. He said, man, how you doing? I said, go, Father, how you doing? He said, I'm doing great. He said, how long you sober? Then, you know, the 411. You know, I'm giving him all the information. He said, who's your sponsor? I says, I don't have one. Because I was a pretty smart guy. He knew I was a sharp guy. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. So I got my roommate to be my sponsor. God forbid should I ever be questioned again. And the only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. I would see him at the meeting and say, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him. Know what I used to do? I used to tell all the people, you won't believe this guy. He wants me to do this. He wants me to do that. He didn't do nothing. He put the hand of AA out there. I slapped it away and I character assassinated the guy to boot. I mean, that's how much of an idiot I was. So the second anniversary come. I don't celebrate it. A month after the second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. Friday night meeting, I go to the Wissanoma meeting, and there's a guy there by the name of Troubles. Now, that's a hard-earned nickname. You get a nickname like Troubles, you know, that's hard-earned. He's sober a number of years. I haven't seen this guy. Now, I actually saw him when I first got sober. My first outside meeting, I saw him, and I couldn't believe it because I had not seen him in years. I don't know whether he was dead or in jail, because he used to be in jail quite often. Here he was sober in AA, and he was walking the walk. He had a glow about him. It wasn't in the rooms of AA. It was in the neighborhood where I saw him. He was treating women with dignity and respect. He was treating others. And he was a dude you could tell he wasn't a guy to be tangled with, but he wasn't carrying himself like that anymore. He was just a true gentleman. So I go up to the meeting afterwards. I said, Bobby, I said, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? He looked at me. He said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years, and I'm sticking my chest out. I said, yeah, he likes me. He says, I need to tell you, you're full of shit. Now, that's not the response I'm looking for. He says, I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. You're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to a step meeting. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment, and you're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm talking to myself, who's he talking to? I'm sober 25 months. I'm selling the grapevines. I got it going on. But I was just not. I was nuts. But I didn't say that. I looked him dead in the eye. I said, that's okay. That's what I'm willing to do. He took me back to his house, and he introduced me to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And he kind of used some colorful language with me because that's what I needed. And he just told me to shut up. I didn't know nothing. And we go through the first couple steps. And then a few minutes later, we're on our knees together to say the third step prayer. Now, I'm kind of weirded out by this. I said maybe he was in jail a little too long. But, you know, but the truth was, you know what? I knew he was a good man. I knew I was safe. And all that other ignorance I had inside me, it was like, it was finally like the good side was like winning out, because like my devil, you know, the pitchfork, and the other guy, like he got stabbed to death years ago, but it was like the good guy finally won out. Like I said, I had some faith, and as little as was, but that's all I needed to grasp on. So we said the third step prayer, and when we got done, he said, Bobby, did we do a third step? We pick paper and pen up and do a fourth step. I said, whoa, easy does it. Let's keep it simple. How about I don't drink and go to a meeting, you know? And I know these slogans, they serve a purpose, but I was using them as an excuse not to do any work. But I didn't want to do one of these inventories. I'm going to a meeting, and people say, oh, doing my four stuff, stirring stuff up, feel like drinking, feel like going out. I want to stick a gun on my mouth. You can't get no further out than that. So I did my fourth step, and it was not a big deal. Everything I wrote down, I did. Not a big deal at all. That next step, that fifth step's a big deal. I'm a bright guy. I got this figured out. I called my sponsor up. I said, Bobby, I want to go on a retreat this weekend. We'll do that fifth step with a priest. He said, man, that's fantastic. When you get done, stop by my house so you can do it with me. And you know how it is sometimes? You're on the phone with your sponsor. You feel like saying, like, oh, you're daft. You hear what I said? I'm sorry. But, you know, like, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sorry. I still do that, you know, but you feel like saying, like, do you hear what I said, you know, but before I could say something flippantly, he said, Bobby, he says, I am your sponsor, and these next two steps are character defects. I think I need to know what they are before I help you with them, even though I have a good idea, and he hung up on me. Now, the truth is, on my fourth step, the resentments, I got the whole deal, God, church, you know, my desire to do the fifth step with the priest, it wasn't to be spiritually enlightened. In fact, I still hate the church at this time. The truth was, there were things on my inventory that I was embarrassed about, that I was afraid to do with my sponsor, for the fear that he would pass judgment on me, he would ridicule me, or even worse, he would betray the confidence and disclose to other people what I was about to tell him. And that's the truth. And which also tells me that my fear list wasn't quite done. I never did that fifth step with that priest. I did it with my sponsor, and they turned out to be unfounded fears. My sponsor did none of those things. He didn't pass judgment on me. He didn't ridicule me. And to the best of my knowledge, he never told anybody else. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his experience with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness in which I thought I was the only one. And I'll be forever grateful for that. See, he also had taken someone's life, but he had paid the price. You know, he had gone to prison in the 60s, and he did his time. But that's not why he asked him to be my sponsor. Like I said, I saw the way he was living in the neighborhood. That's why I asked him to be my sponsor, because he was walking the walk. So I'm about to leave his house. When we get done, he says, yo, where are you going? And I said, I'm going home. He said, no, you got to sit quietly for that 1 hour. Now, I can't sit quietly for 3 or 4 minutes in a meeting, but I sat quietly. He lived by himself. He had a quiet room set up in his house, and I sat quietly. And it had to be for a little bit more than an hour, because he eventually knocked on the door to see if I drifted off. And I didn't. I did not off. At this point, I'm sober about 32, 33 months. Please, if you know, I wish I could tell you something different, but the truth is, it took me 32, 33 months. I didn't wake up one day and decide I was going to be a decent human being and got involved in the steps. I didn't get involved in the steps through any volition of my own. I got involved in the steps through pain and desperation. And that's my experience. So I sat quietly for that hour, and afterwards, the only way I can describe my experience is that the screaming inside stopped. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but I need to tell you, it's an incredible relief. It really is. I mean, the head's no longer racing. You know what? I didn't burn my fourth step when I did my fifth step because my sponsor told me I would need these for the rest of the steps, you know? 6 and 7, character defects. I mean, I didn't know what these were. I knew when I drank I was a character. I found out when I did my inventory that I had no character whatsoever. See, the reason I had to write these things out because I see it in black and white. See, I thought very highly of myself, and I told people I didn't have a spiritual awakening, I had a root awakening. See, I thought I was the greatest cop in the city, and that's not true. You know, I actually engaged in behaviors that brought dishonor among my coworkers. I justified my actions by the nature of the work that I was doing, but there was men and women who were doing the exact same work that I was doing, and they served with integrity. I thought I was the great uncle because I was hooking my nephews and nieces up with, you know, a lot of nice things, Christmas, their birthdays, you know, I was single, I was making money. The truth was, towards the end of my drinking, I wasn't even invited to family functions, you know. My sister, my older sister, Jay Marie, I love her. We're incredibly tight. We fought as kids, but you know that happens when you get it, you know, 8 kids in the house, but you know, no one else can mess with her. So I love my sister. Early 80s, the punk rock days. I wasn't a punk rocker. I dated them. They were fun. So I go to my sister's wedding. My date at the time is wearing a leopard skin miniskirt. I know that's not wedding attire, but she was hot. She looked. My uncles were checking her out too. So, but I go to my sister's wedding. I get there late. We're drunk. I mean, we're really 3 sheets to the wind. I mean, we're nuts. We show up. And then I said, listen, let's just slide in the last pew, not a big deal. At the end of the service, my sister walks down the aisles, our eyes meet, and I can see the hurt. Like, she can't believe that I would do this on her wedding day. My dad's behind her. He got a different look in his eye. I said, listen, they're going for pictures. Why don't we go get a couple drinks? We'll slide in the reception, not a big deal. She thought that was a good idea, like she needed any convincing. We show up at the reception, they're all halfway through dinner. And this could actually be like one of them Southwest Airline commercials, you know, you want to get away? She comes in, the girl that I'm with, and she trips over one of them big round things where the servers rest all the dinners, you know. And she trips over them, it must have been about 8 to 10 dinners, went clashing to the floor. And there was like 300 people in the hall, and they turned around. And, you know, we want to get away. Here it is. It's supposed to be my sister's, the happiest day of her life. I mean, and I love my sister. I would give my life for my sister, and I do this to her. Like, how do I make amends for that, you know? And so the seventh step is, you know, I got the list in the sixth step, my character defects, and I become willing. And if I don't have the willingness, I pray for the willingness. I was always taught if I'm ever stuck on a step, you fall back on the immediate previous step. It will help you through it. So the seventh step, I got a laundry list of character defects, you know. And my sponsor said, Bobby, you need to put legs on those prayers. I mean, I can pray all day long. God, help me be patient. Help me be patient. But during the course of the day, should you cross my path and I choose not to be patient, I lash out in sarcasm, which is nothing but anger, also referred to as language of the Irish. But if I lash out in sarcasm, that prayer for patience goes out the window. I need to do things. I mean, God will do for me what I can't do for myself, but this is a program of action. The eighth step, because I didn't burn my fourth step, half my eighth step was done. I used to be one of these dudes, I never harmed anybody but myself. That should be right there, the tip off, I never did my inventory. Because once I did my inventory, I found out I harmed everybody I came in contact with. And unfortunately, my experience, those closest to me were harmed the most. So I had to throw more names down on there. And the ninth step, direct amends, you know. No phone calls, no letters from me because I didn't beat you with a bat or didn't steal anything through the mail or over the phone. And I'd like to share 2 experiences on my ninth step. I'm at this meeting. It was about 18 years ago. I'm at this meeting. I have not seen this guy since 1977. He's not on my fear list, not for any reason. I just plain forgot. They say more will be revealed. As soon as he walked down the steps, I recognized the guy. He didn't recognize me, though. You know, we stayed sober long enough, we clean up, and he didn't recognize me. So I'm sitting at the table, I'm about to get introduced, I stand up, I look, I'm dead in the eyes, and my name is Bobby Coyle, I'm an alcoholic. Now I need to take a quick moment to tell you why you use my full name. Actually, we're doing a tradition workshop tomorrow, and I probably expect about 8 or 9 of you there. But I like to tell you why I use my full name. All of a sudden, we get sober, it's like we join the mafia. Everyone gets a nickname. You know, there's Red Sweater Jerry and Bucktooth Mary and Frank the Fox and Peppy George and Jimmy the Coat and Frank the Fox and John the Brick. I mean, everyone gets a nickname, right? Everybody in my neighborhood knows I'm a stark, raving lunatic drunk. There's those little telltale signs. They come outside, they catch me, I'm urinating on their car. My girlfriend's rolled her clothes out. I wonder how you sign that, urinating on my car. My girlfriend threw the clothes out the window. I mean, you know, everyone knows I'm a drunk. God forbid I should be, my reputation should be tarnished by you finding out I go to AA. It's just nuts, you know. The 11 tradition is real clear. Personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. That means you will never see my full face clearly identified on the television or in the newspaper, or hear my full name on the radio, which is Robert Ignatius Benedict Quill III, is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That would be a violation of the 11th tradition. I mean, God forbid, 3 o'clock in the morning, you feel like drinking, call information. Yeah, I'd like to have Frank the Fox's phone number. Or you want to go to a hospital and visit one of these beloved old-timers. Yeah, I'm here to see Jimmy the Coat. I mean, God forbid. You know, this is not a secret society. In fact, Dr. Bob and the good old-timers wrote that anonymity is spiritually inspired and secrecy is fear-inspired. It is not a secret society. However, I have no right to break your anonymity. You don't want to use your full name? That's cool. I was very involved in service back home, and we use our full name, so off that soapbox, back to the meeting. I looked this guy dead in the eye. Tomorrow, what's that, 2:30 tomorrow? Tradition, so, 8 or 9 of you will have enough chairs. So I looked this guy dead in the eye and said, my name's Bobby Cooley, I'm an alcoholic. He nodded, he recognized me. Now, I need to tell you, he was a big dude. I used to like to fight big guys. I don't know why, he wasn't good at it, but I liked to do it. People say he had heart, you know. I also had 2 black eyes. So I said, my name's Bobby Cooley, I'm an alcoholic. He nodded, he recognized. See, when I got done speaking, I was told making amends is much more than saying I'm sorry, because there are 2 words to me that don't mean squat. And financial amends are easy. I go in my pocket and pay it back. But what about that emotional damage? That psychological damage? How do I make amends to my sister? How do I make amends to this guy? So I was taught that since I publicly embarrassed this guy, the least I could do is publicly make amends to him. It wasn't a grandstand. So I told the group what I used to do to this guy. And I turned to him. His name was Bob. I said, Bob, I'm truly sorry. And as long as I stay sober, I hope I never treat another human being the way I treated you. You know what? He came up and he hugged me. It was an incredible experience. So after the meetings, we're talking. I said, Bob, I ain't seen you in years. How you doing? He said, Bobby, I'm sober. 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, get out of here. Now the arrogance creeps back in, right? Because everybody in AA knows me in Philadelphia. I'm not saying that they like me, but I'm saying they know me. I'm involved. I'm doing the deal, right? And I said, and now I live in South Philadelphia. Bob lives in Roxborough, which is like the northwest section of the city. This particular meeting, we're at 11th and Rockland. It's in North Philadelphia. This is a meeting that he and I normally would not go to. I said, Bob, what brings you here today? He said, Bobby, I was slipping through the meeting directory. I just wanted to go to a different meeting, and for some reason, this meeting just jumped out at me. Our meeting directory is 90 pages thick. We have 1,600 meetings a week. He said, for some reason, this meeting just jumped out at me. Now, I had 2 choices. I could do what I did, or I could do what I always did, which is, when you have 8 siblings in a 10-and-a-half-year span, there is a very close resemblance. So people would come up to me and say, hey, you SOB, I remember you. I said, oh, no, you got me confused. You're talking about my brother Brian or my brother Sean. Not me, you know. And I had to make amends to my brothers. It was just not. I know you're cool. I don't know which one. It's just nuts. Another experience on a nice set quickly. I was at my home group for a while, a number of years ago, was the Stepping Stones group. We had a business meeting Sunday morning, and I made a motion. It was definitely for the betterment of AA. It had to be since I made it. Crazy thing happened. I've never seen it happen. My motion doesn't get seconded. And I need to tell you, every motion gets seconded, even though you know it ain't got a chance to pass. You feel sorry for the poor dude who made it. You know what? I know he looks like an idiot. It doesn't have a shot, but I'll second it so I can save him some face, you know? But most of all, there was a guy from my neighborhood at the meeting. And you know what? We grew up in a neighborhood, there were certain rules. Everyone knew what they were. You know, you always had your boys back. It didn't matter. You got on out of the neighborhood with him, he opened his mouth, he started a fight, you jumped in, you got beat up, but that was okay, you always had your boys back. You never dated anybody else's ex. You didn't do it. Say, man, I know you're cute, but you went to Frankie's prom, sorry, can't talk to you. It's a loyalty thing, you just don't do it. So, but I'm making eye contact with this guy. I mean, I'm looking straight through him, like, get your hand up. But he looks straight, doesn't get his hand up. My motion goes down in flames. I couldn't believe it. I'm at work a few weeks later. One of my coworkers came up to me. He was in the program, and he said, Bobby, Freddie Wheels is outside. He wants to take care of some sort of business. And I peeked out the window. I saw him out there. I said, you know what? Tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall. He can't do that here. A few weeks later, that same coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels died last night. And the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. As God is my judge, I cannot tell you what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. Here was a guy that was put in my path many, many times. I would walk into the room and say hi to every man in the room but except to Freddie. And Freddie would even say hello to me. I can't tell you how many times I crossed his path. And, I thought I would, I would do it in my time. You know, the arrogance that I had, you know. And the moment that coworker called me, he said, Bobby, because he always spoke so highly of you, I felt about yay big. I've been praying for Freddie ever since. See, that's two experiences on the ninth step. An opportunity, I took the opportunity and I reaped the rewards. And a second opportunity, and I can't tell you, many opportunities. And I chose not to do it. I figured I would do it in my time. See, that key word in the ninth step is wherever possible, not whenever possible. Whenever's time, wherever's place. And for me, it's never the right time because I'm too busy, easy, doesn't it? You know? The 10th step for me is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. If I'm standing up here and tell you to do a 10th step every day, that's not true. But I'm pretty good. 4, 5, 6 times a week. Twice a week. And I used to say, if I'm not practicing these principles on a daily basis, no one knows but me. That's not true either. See, when I'm not practicing these principles on a daily basis, I operate in nitwit mode. Should you cross my path when I operate in nitwit mode, you too are affected, you know. And it was funny because now I can laugh at myself. You know, it's just funny. I tell you a story. A few years ago, it was our group's anniversary. It was my job to get the rolls right. So I go get the rolls. I'm over at Bakery 3rd and Poplar, and I'm coming back, and some guy beeps. And, you know, sometimes when I drive, it's like I have Tourette syndrome. You know, I flip out, and I just go nuts. And so I'm at the anniversary that night, and Carl comes up to me. Carl just passed away not that long ago, and he was a decent man. He was just a real good guy. He came up to me, he said, Bobby, he said, I was over at 3rd and Poplar today, I saw you. He said, I beeped and waved, and you waved back. And he said it, he had a twinkle in his eyes. Oh, man, I gave Carl the finger, I can't believe it. You know, I mean, I shouldn't do that to anybody, but to him, I mean, every aid community has a dude like this guy. I mean, sober 40 years, I'm just a nice guy, and it's, oh, man, that's hurt, you know. I never get away with nothing. I thought I do. I pay the price every time I do, you know. I don't want to give you the impression I'm the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not. You know, I invite you to come live with me for a week. See what type of a guy I am. I make mistakes, but making mistakes doesn't get me drunk. It's not learning from those mistakes or justifying those mistakes that will lead to the arrogance, that will lead to the drink. I'm just a regular guy from the neighborhood trying to do the right thing, you know, and I do that a day at a time. The way it is today, I got a wonderful way of life. I never married, no kids. What happened to that kid? You know, the kid that I ran over on the bike, you know the old saying, God takes care of drunks, fools, and kids. I actually hit the trifecta that day. Nothing happened to that kid. He wasn't hurt seriously. And in fact, I was able to make amends to that kid. I didn't know him personally, but I knew his family. He was the same age as one of my younger brothers, and I had an opportunity to make amends to him. And God forbid, if he was hurt seriously, it may have turned around all the circumstances. It could be a whole different situation today, you know. I still work for the city. I'm no longer a cop, so please relax for you guys with warrants. And I'm sure there's one or two in a crowd like this. You got to take care of that stuff, though. We got computers. Like back in the day, we lost paper. We don't lose stuff today. And I tell you, when you do things on your own, you're dealing with a position of strength. Seriously, you got to take care of that stuff, and I can help you. Talk to me afterwards. I got friends throughout the country, different jurisdictions, you know. But I do something else. I love my job. I got a great way of life. I got involved. I had some health problems, and I talk quickly about young people's, and then I'll wrap up. I got diagnosed with lung cancer. I was actually training to do the Boston Marathon. Typical alcoholic. We just can't jog, right? I want to run Boston. You know, I just not. But actually, you got to qualify to run Boston. You just can't. I mean, there's a couple lottery spots for elite runners, but you have to qualify. So I was actually training to do the Marine Corps Marathon. And I'm not the most graceful guy, and one day I'm running up the East River Drive, and I trip, and I hurt my shoulder, and you know, just threw my stride off, and I said, yeah, I ought to get this checked out. And I go, and it wasn't the trauma from the fall. It wasn't that at all. It was actually lung cancer. It was a tumor pressing against my lung. Now, I've never smoked in my life. I mean, a little reefer, but that don't count. I ain't never smoked. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. And I'm 33. I'm sober 6-7 years at this point. I'm like, I'm going places. I can't believe this. Man, lung cancer. I had to go get a second opinion. And it got confirmed. And I don't want you to think I handled this well, because I didn't. I had a really tough time with this. You know, and I went through treatment. I bounced back. And you bounce good back. I mean, you're 33. You're sober 6 years, 7 years. I mean, you bounce back pretty quickly. Then I really got sick. And I couldn't make meetings after a while. And that's pretty tough to do. When you have 1,600 meetings a week, there's no excuse not to make a meeting. And then after I got out of hospital, I was laid up in my house, and people start coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm just not talking about my friends. I'm talking about people that I may have met once or twice at the assembly. Or I'm talking about people I never met before. They were coming with a friend of mine. They were bringing a new guy to come to my house. You're looking at a liar, thief, and a cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people came to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm a pretty firm believer. I mean, thank God I had good insurance and the good doctors. But the truth is, I'm a believer in prayer. And I had people praying for me. So I've been fighting this back and forth. I go up and down, you know, with the weight. I glow in the dark. I lost my hair. It came back this color. What am I going to do? Actually, just a couple months, I just had throat surgery about in early November. And so I couldn't talk or eat for a month. And the fact I couldn't talk, I thought that brought a lot of joy to a lot of people. That was an early Christmas gift of my sponsees, you know. The deal is, when my diagnosis got confirmed, I thought I may have had an excuse to go out and get loaded. And I may have, but I really didn't have a reason to go out and get loaded. I had a pretty good life. I've been to thousands of meetings, and I saw some men and women go through some terrible things of their own, and they got through it one day at a time without picking up a drink, you know. And that's what we do. Life on life's terms, and we all know it's an ugly, unjust world out there, but we don't get caught up in that stuff. One foot in front of the other, 24 hours at a time, and that's all we got to do. And sometimes we got to break those hours down. Hey, listen, I'm not going to drink for the next hour, and do it that way. It's a wonderful way of life. I wish you luck. I wish you well. I don't wish you luck, because luck ain't got nothing to do with it. I don't want you to think recovery is the lottery and it spins and it's like your day to drink. It doesn't work that way. I heard people say, "I did the steps, I still drank." That's nonsense. Nowhere in the steps does it say go out and buy a 40. You know, it's, and I don't know, maybe I got the misprint edition, but actually I got a book that tells me there's a guarantee for me to not to pick up a drink, and that's working with other alcoholics, you know, and that's where the 12 step comes in play, you know. The 12 steps, I mean, it's we carry the message, alcoholics, you know. What's the message? You know, having had a spiritual awakening, you know, as the result of these steps. That's what happened after we do 1 through 11. We get a spiritual awakening. I'm not talking about burning bushes or voices from above. In fact, thank God I haven't heard voices in years. We're talking about the change of attitude. I had the change of attitude. I'm not the same guy I was almost 22 years ago, you know. But I have a responsibility to carry the message to the alcoholics. I don't go to as many meetings as I used to. I go about 5-6 times a week. And I tell you why I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because a newcomer doesn't know that I live at 707 Sears Street. That's why I go to meetings. You know, it's to carry the message to the new guy. In fact, when I go to meetings, I run into guys I sponsor. If they haven't talked to me in a while, I don't talk to them because they already got my number. I'll send them over when you talk to the new guy. The preamble says our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. If I'm only staying sober and not helping other alcoholics, that's half measures, and half measures avail us nothing. It doesn't say half measures avail us something, half measures avail us a little. It says half measures avail us nothing. Zip. That's what we're supposed to do. We got a statement of responsibility. I'm responsible. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to always be there, and for that I'm responsible. I make regular attendance meetings, and, you know, I see a lot of young guys in the meetings, and I can go up to them. I know they see me. They see me as an older guy. I say, "Yo, man," I said, "I got sober in my 20s. You know, I went back to school. I know what that's about. I can share my experience, strength, and hope." I got involved in young people's, and I need to tell you, my very first young people's was actually Icky Pot in Salt Lake City, 1989. was my first Young People's Conference. And actually, our Saturday night speaker that night, who's going to be here tomorrow, a guy, Jimmy D. from New York. Jimmy eventually became the delegate of New York. I'll tell you a quick history about Young People's. The very first conference, as you know, or you may not know, was held in Niagara Falls. It was a joint venture between the Philadelphia and Toronto Young People. And they thought Niagara Falls was halfway, which, I know, it tells you the guys from Philadelphia don't know geography. The very first Young People's in the country actually was in Philadelphia. And their name was the 35 and Under Group. And the reason they created a meeting was because the big people in AA, the mainstream AA, were not taking them seriously. They did not create to start a special interest meeting. They created a group as a venue to get involved in service. And once you became 36, you were still allowed to go to their meetings. You just could not vote at their business meetings. And two men out of that early group later became delegates from Area 59 in eastern Pennsylvania. I had the privilege to interview about 20 people who made that very first Young People's Conference in Niagara Falls. And actually, I talked to this one guy. He actually gave the actual photograph, a black and white photograph in mint condition. I interviewed him in my house about 15 years ago, and we actually turned it over to the archives at ICIPA. So it's not a special interest group. They say, is anyone with room to grow? Believe me, I still got room to grow. You know, but I think it's a blast. You know, it's about having a good time, and I'm all for having a good time. It's not about busting joints up, and I've seen that happen in certain conferences, but I've seen that happen in other places too. I know people like to take shots at young people about certain behaviors, but you know what the fact is? Young people, we're going to engage in certain behaviors, whether we're in an AA conference or whether we're in a college dorm or any other type of setting. However, we got a responsibility for acting in a responsible way. I mean, we can have blasts, and I don't want to put a damper on anyone's enthusiasm because that's the last thing I want to do. But I got involved in Young People's, and there are several people here. So in Salt Lake City, I run into Jimmy. Jimmy becomes a delegate and becomes one of my better friends today. In 90, we were in Montreal. Man, incredible experience. We had almost 4,000 people there. 91, San Francisco, my boy Joe C. here from Worcester, Mass. Joe is one of his speakers. There he goes. You know, and I got friends from all over. And then all the other different PAs started, the regional PAs, and I think it's great, man. Bill Wilson talks about the young people being, actually, in 1969, Philadelphia has hosted ICIPA three times. 1960, 1969, and 1976. And it's actually Bill Wilson wrote a letter to the young people in 69. He couldn't make it, but he wrote a beautiful letter. He was talking about how the young people are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new and all these different guys and girls are set up from the different cities here and you're trying to bid or make outreach for your conferences, I saw them out there in the lobby. Show up, man. It's a blast. It's a great time. I'll finish up with this. I grew up in a neighborhood where a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood where the sign of success, very few people went to school. They want to get a union card, you know. Electrician, iron worker, no one wants to be a carpenter. They're all scabs. But, you know, you know. And unless you didn't get arrested, you become a cop or a fireman. You get involved in the service. But, you know what, let's say you join one of the trades. Let's say you become an iron worker. You're an apprentice, right? One day a week you go to school, 4 days a week you go to the job, and then at the end of the 4 years you become a journeyman. Alcoholics Anonymous is the same way. You're an apprentice. You're a new guy. You grab yourself a journeyman, a sponsor. I save these remarks because I'm done in about 2 minutes. If your sponsor has not done the steps, he or she has no business sponsoring you. How do you find out your sponsor's done the steps? I know. It's a test. You ask them. You're going to hear two things. Yes or no. The person says yes. That's your person. He or she takes you under their wing. They share their experience, strength, and hope with you. You get your experience, strength, and hope. You become a journeyman. You take an apprentice under your wing. It's been working that way since June 10th, 1935. Why do you need a dirtball from South Philly to come up here and tell you to do it any differently? You know, it's a wonderful way of life. I've really had a great time. And seriously, you guys from Boston, I mean, you guys are great. It's a wicked piss of a time. Thank you very much.